Lecture 11, Lancelot and Guinevere.
Crete d'Artois' best-known romance may be Lancelot or The Knight of the Cart. In fact, the romance is called The Knight of the Cart, and only later does the name Lancelot become attached to it, so there'll be no confusion that The Knight of the Cart is Lancelot. This is a fact it's good for us to know before we begin the story, because one of the most remarkable storytelling techniques that Chrétien uses in the story is that he does not name Lancelot. He has Guinevere name Lancelot more than three-fourths of the way through the story. Until that time, Lancelot is the unknown knight, or the knight known as the Knight of the Cart. This work is one that Chrétien himself dedicated to his patroness, Countess Marie of Champagne, who was a daughter of Eleanor of Aquitaine and Louis VII of France. Indeed, Chrétien claims that Marie told him the story. And while praising Marie in ways one could only call voluptuous, he also, therefore, gives over some responsibility for what we see as a transparent immorality of this story to someone else who originated it. He does not claim, as he does with the story of Eric and Enid, that he originated this story. He claims with all others who told the story of Eric and Enid that they were inferior storytellers. It is his version of this story that will last forever. But when he tells us the story of the Knight of the Cart, he talks always about those who gave him this story. And we'll talk later about the ways in which he even may have had someone else finish the story for him. All of Chrétien's stories are fixed around rituals, rituals that mark moments of transition and change, rituals that also give people a sense of purpose, place, belonging, a way to mark a year, a way to mark their movement through a liturgical and personal calendar. This time, an unknown knight bursts into King Arthur's hall on Ascension Day and boasts that he has captured and has imprisoned many people of Arthur's whom Arthur has been unable to save. In this very strange scene in which the king seems to admit this, Arthur also may seem to us to be very passive. The knight went right up to the king, and where the king sat among his nobles, he gave him no greeting, but said, King Arthur, I hold in captivity knights, ladies, and maidens from your own land and from your own household. However, I give you this news of them, not because I intend to return them to you. On the contrary, I wish to tell you that you lack the strength and resources to be able to get them back from me. And you may be sure you'll die without ever being in a position to help them. The king replies that he must put up with this if he can do nothing about it, though he is deeply aggrieved on this account. Does this sound to us like the heroic Arthur or Geoffrey of Monmouth? Does it sound to us like the aggressive king who, when Kilhuk brings him adventures to be accomplished, and Kilhuk and Olwen, is willing immediately to say that his whole court will set out after those adventures? This instead is an Arthur who says, be that as it may, if nothing else will happen, there's nothing I can do about it. At this point, the king also becomes a victim of a very strange verbal subterfuge. Because Meleagant, whom we will find out later is the knight who has taken all of Arthur's people prisoner, Meleagant challenges the king. He says, well, he says, if you give me your queen to take away with me, if you find anyone who will challenge me and overwhelm me, I will return not only the queen, but all the other prisoners from Logres, your kingdom, that I have. No one from the court responds immediately, but Sir Kay, Arthur's seneschal, who is also ambitious, always pouting, usually inept in all Arthurian stories from the end of the Welsh period. From that point, Kay says, I'm leaving this court. I'm not happy here anymore. And Arthur says, my God, you can't leave. What would I do without you? You're more important to me than anyone except Guinevere. And he says, no, I'm leaving. There's nothing you can do to stop me. And finally, Arthur turns to Guinevere and says, listen, you're very convincing. Could you please convince Kay to stay? I'll be so unhappy if he leaves. And Guinevere goes to Kay and says, Kay, I will give you anything. And Arthur will give you anything if you will agree to stay. And Kay says, then I know just what I want. Goes to Arthur. Arthur and says, "What I want is for you to hand over Guinevere to me so that I can be the knight who goes out and challenges Meleagant in the forest. And I will be able to win not only Guinevere, but also free all of the imprisoned people of Logres." Sounds like a very good deal, doesn't it? But by now, we know Arthur has been tricked by this verbal subterfuge. He's made this deal that says Kay can have whatever he wants. What Kay wants is to take the queen away. We all know Kay's reputation from previous stories, that Kay will make big boasts, but he will little be able to fulfill them. So when he goes to the forest, of course, with the lady, we see her reaction as well. This is a depressed queen who's submitting herself to a strange scene of honor. The king entrusts her to Kay, and he leads her away. Everyone follows them out, all very troubled, without exception. You may be sure that Kay was fully armed. His horse was brought to the middle of the courtyard and beside it the palfrey fit for the queen. Miserable and depressed, the queen sighs as she mounts. Then so softly that no one may hear her, she said, "Oh, if only you knew. You would never, I think, allow me to be led away a single step without opposition." She thought she had said that very quietly, but it had been overheard. Meleagant, the knight in the forest, wounds Kay and takes the queen as prisoner. And he takes Kay as well away to this strange land that no one has ever seen. Sir Gawain and an unnamed knight, we all know it's the disguised Sir Lancelot, each follow to rescue the queen. Lancelot follows so swiftly and ferociously that horse after horse dies in the ferocious mounting and riding that he and makes them endure. They die under the strain. Fully armed knights, we know, are not Olympic runners. Once his horse dies, Lancelot and his huge armor is pretty ineffective as someone who's going to be able to pursue and find Guinevere, unless he can find another horse or some other means of conveyance. The only means of conveyance that comes forward for him is a dwarf who is driving a cart, a kind of cart that's used to take felons to the gallows. Lancelot hesitates only seconds before he hops into this cart. And being conveyed in this fashion subjects Lancelot to all forms of humiliation from all levels of society. Let's look at that scene. In those days, the cart was put to the same use as pillories are now. In every fair-sized town where one finds over 3,000 of them, there was at that time just one. And that, like the pillories, was used for all of those who were guilty of treason and murder, for those defeated in judicial combat, and for thieves who had stolen the property of others or engaged in violent highway robbery. Anyone caught committing a crime was put in the cart and led through the streets, thereafter losing all his legal rights and never again being heard or honored in any court. It was at that time, because of the cart's sinister nature, that the saying originated, "When you see a cart in your path, cross yourself and turn your thoughts to God so that it does not bring you bad luck." This knight, on foot and without his lance, comes up behind the cart, and seeing the dwarf, he, holding a long switch in his hand like a carter, says, "Dwarf, tell me in God's name if you've seen my lady queen pass this way." The boorish, vulgar dwarf — dwarves are always boorish and vulgar in these stories — was not prepared to give him any news of her, saying instead, "If you want to get into the cart I'm driving, you'll be able to find out by tomorrow what happened to the queen. If you don't, you won't." With that, he went on his way without even waiting a moment for the knight. Before he climbed into the cart, the knight hesitated merely two steps. But it was unfortunate for him that he did so, and unfortunate that his fear of shame stopped him from jumping all at once, for he will rue that day. Everyone who knows everything in this poem And everyone in the poem always seems to know everything, knows that this knight has hopped into this cart. There's no one whom he meets along the way in any of his adventures, in any town, in any tournament, in any part of the countryside who does not know that he is the knight who got into a cart. And he is therefore known not only as the knight of a cart, but also as a knight prisoner, as one who's given up his right to be a knight, as one who has somehow, in some way, foregone his legal status. This is a wonderful metaphor for the illicit love of Lancelot and Guinevere. We know that he is in a prison, and his prison is love itself. Others think him guilty of some great crime if he's riding in the cart. And we know, of course, that his secret love for the queen becomes a great crime. Lancelot then learns that the knight who has taken Kay and the queen prisoner is Meleagant, son of the good king Bagdemagu, king of Gore, and he sets off in pursuit of Meleagant. There are always onlookers in this poem. It's a remarkable poem in which always it seems that Lancelot is traveling through a ceremonial kind of landscape, with people seeing him in this cart, marking him in this cart, always making fun of him as someone who is outside society as he's in this cart. But furthermore, it's not just knights who challenge and mock him. It's also ladies who ask him for favors. So along the way, even though he is hot in pursuit of Guinevere, he stops in order to aid ladies in need. He stops in order to grant favors to ladies. We see that there is a wonderful reciprocal relationship between Lancelot and ladies who need either justice or mercy. Sometimes these ladies need a little more than justice or mercy, and sometimes it's that they ask from Lancelot. Lancelot is the most difficult of all of our courtly lovers because he is the most desirable man in the world. When women look at him, they sometimes forget that they're ladies, and they find themselves in a state of perplexing desire. Then he goes his way, we're told, at the end of one adventure, as he tries to get just from morning to nightfall without being overcome by another knight or overwhelmed by another lady. He met a damsel coming his way who was exceedingly beautiful and attractive, elegantly dressed and adorned. Sounds like a description of a lady to me. The damsel greets him discreetly and politely, and he replies, "May God keep you healthy and happy, young lady." Then she replied to him, "My home, sir, is all ready for your lodging if you're prepared to accept it. But you'll be given hospitality on a condition, that you sleep with me. Those are the terms of my offer." Many people would have thanked her 500 times for this favor. Yet it left Lancelot quite miserable, and he gave her a different reply. "I thank you, damsel, for your offer of hospitality, and I'm most grateful for it. But if you were agreeable, I could do very well without the sleeping arrangement." "By my eyes," said the maiden, "my offer depends upon that." There's nothing else for it. He feels no choice. He agrees to her condition. It pains him deeply to consent. And while just alone that hurts him, he will feel even more gravely distressed when he goes to bed. Of course, we probably don't need to be told that many adventures intervene before Lancelot finds himself even near a bed with the lady, including the appearance of a rapacious knight who goes into her bedroom before Lancelot does and tries to rape her. And Lancelot comes and protects and saves her from this rapacious knight, therefore earning her gratitude and her willingness to let him have a single night in a single bed in single peace. We find, of course, that he is someone who wants to preserve himself from other ladies because he's entirely absorbed and enraptured by Guinevere. In spite of his hostess's attempt at seduction then, since he's in love with Guinevere, he manages to fend off this and other ladies. And though youths always want to challenge Lancelot to battle, their fathers more easily discern the stuff of which he's made. And some keep their sons physically restrained. They literally imprison them to avoid their certain humiliation, if not death, at Lancelot's hands. So we have here not just independent knights, or knights who guard a bridge, or knights who guard a river, who are the ones who tell Lancelot that they want to fiercely interact with him. We have also an extraordinary number of fathers and sons in this extraordinary poem, a poem in which fathers are always trying to protect their sons from being rash and foolhardy, the experienced, grizzled warriors who look at Lancelot keenly and know what they are seeing, and the sons who look at Lancelot and simply see the opportunity to make a better reputation. Reputation can kill, and in the case of Lancelot, reputation inevitably will, unless these knights ask, as they so often do, for mercy. But somehow, when a father is there, he needs to protect his son from this kind of certain death and absolute danger. So we have very touching scenes of fathers and sons in this story, at the same time that we have extraordinary and absolutely lonely, solitary women who seem to have many castles and who are in search of men who can both man them and their castles. Passing through a very strange landscape, from which no one who enters can escape, Lancelot first comes upon a cemetery. And a priest there says, there is a tomb marked first for Sir Gawain, others for other knights of Arthur's courts, all of them already engraved with the names of these heroes. And that there is one tomb that the knight in the cart understands immediately is meant for him. The priest tells him that it would take the strength of 10 men to move the marble slab from the top of this tomb. Lancelot easily moves the slab from the top of the tomb, and what it exposes underneath is not a space of death, but a space of adventure. A strange space which seems to be the hollow entry to the other world in which Meleagant and all those who have been taken prisoner from Logres, and now Queen Guinevere herself, live in the world of Gore, the world of King Bagdemago. So we have here in this strange place, in this scene where Lancelot becomes like Christ, opening the gates of hell so that the people of Arthur's Logres can go to their rightful homes, an extraordinary way of suggesting the new worlds that one enters after one leaves the world of Arthur's own kingdom, the subscribed and prescribed and enclosed world of that adventure becomes the open, daring, frightening world, but the world which has its magical component. Once you enter, you're not allowed to leave, and you will not be allowed to leave until the great Savior comes, who will release all the people after a battle with those at the court of King Bagdemagu and allow people to return to their homes. Interestingly enough, of course, Lancelot is fierce in his desire to get to Guinevere as fast as possible to protect her from any of the terrible adventures that befall many of the damsels along the way. And the most direct approach to Meleagant's castle, which he takes, is the one over the sword bridge. There are only 2 modes of entry once one enters into this world. One is over the sword bridge, and the other is over the underwater bridge. It's the underwater bridge that Lancelot's compatriot Sir Gawain takes, because Gawain is also fast and furious on the heels of this adventure in order to save the queen. But when Lancelot crosses the sword bridge on his hands and his knees, his hands are wounded and bloodied. His feet are torn. We have him there as someone who is himself given wounds that might suggest to us the hands and feet of Christ. He's hit with a lance later. We get him there as a figure who suffers as intensely for his passion as Christ does for his own. When he reaches the castle of King Bagdemagus, we have this wonderful scene in which the king himself says, I welcome you here. I'm so grateful that you're here. I would love to have a man of your distinction come and visit. It's an honor to my court to have you here. And he turns to his son Meleagant and says, Do not do anything so foolish as try to have ado with this man. This man is a very great man. You are not his equal. And this, he says to him, is something that Meleagant is deeply offended by. And we see in the places where he speaks to his father how upset he is. Just now, says Meleagant to his father, I'm bound to hear you out in silence. You can say what you please, but I'm not interested in what you say. I'm not like a hermit, merciful and charitable. I don't intend to be so honorable as to give this man what I most love, the queen. His task won't be performed so promptly or speedily. On the contrary, things will go very differently from what you and he think. We'll not fall out if you help him against me. What do I care if he enjoys peace and a truce with you and all your men? My heart doesn't skip a beat because of that, my father. Rather, so help me God, I'm delighted that he has me to deal with, and I don't want you to do anything for me that would be criticized as disloyalty or treason. You be moral if you want, but let me be cruel. What? Won't you behave in any other way? Says his father. Not at all. Then say no more about it. Now do the best you can, for I'm leaving you and I'm going to speak to this knight. I want to offer and give him my help in every respect, for I'm entirely on his side. Lancelot, who is badly wounded from the sword bridge, enters the battle with Meleagant, but he's losing very badly because of his wounds until he looks up and sees Guinevere watching him. And it's at that very moment that a maiden goes to Guinevere and says, Dear Queen, who is that man? That unknown man we know is the Knight of the Cart. Do you happen to know his name? Young lady, says the Queen, you've put to me a question in which I detect no animosity or treachery, but only goodwill. The knight's name, I believe, is Lancelot of the Lake. God, how my heart is lifted, cheered, and gladdened, says the maiden. She jumps forward and calls to him at the top of her voice so that all the people hear it. Lancelot, she says, turn around and see whose attention is fixed on you. And Lancelot turns and sees up above him the queen herself. And he is absolutely affected, immediately infused with the strength that comes from the increase of love because he's gazed upon his beloved. He grows, we're told, in strength and courage, being greatly helped by love and by the fact that he never hated anything so much as the man who is fighting him. Love and mortal hate, so great that its like was never felt before, makes him so fierce and spirited that Meleagant by no means treats this any more as a game, but is suddenly very afraid of him. At this point, the fighting stops because Bagdemagus goes to Guinevere and says, please save my son's life. And Guinevere says, Lancelot, stop. Instantly, without a second's hesitation, Lancelot stops fighting. Meleagant keeps on until his father has to send down men to restrain him once more. And yet we see that they make an agreement. Meleagant agrees that in a year's time he will come to the court of Arthur, and that time he will fight with Lancelot, and Lancelot at that time will give him no mercy but justice. And we see furthermore that Lancelot's reputation is at a fever pitch. Just as when he goes through the forests and the countryside and the little cities of this land of Gore, when people see him, they compete for his attention. They say, come stay at my house. No, come stay at my house. Please, come stay at my house. I have a better house. I have better food. I've got a better cook. And he says, wait a minute. I'll treat you all as if I stayed at your houses. I don't need to do that in order to feel honor. At this point, then, we're told the people come up to him. They're all blessing Lancelot. It was a time of great joy. All the foreign folk gathered together, rejoicing over Lancelot and saying so that he could hear, truly, sir, we were quite elated. There was a huge crowd present at this happy scene, with everyone struggling and striving to get close to him, to touch him. Those who were able to get closest being more delighted than they could say. There was an abundance of joy and grief there for those who were released from captivity, gave themselves over to joy while Meleagant was very unhappy. Lancelot has in his own world, in other words, the kind of reputation of a rock star. People want to touch him. They want to touch something that has touched him. He is the greatest and most extraordinary of the knights of his time. But when Lancelot then enters the queen's presence, and we might expect the violins to begin, we might expect this moment of reunion to be a sweet and happy one. Instead, the queen is cold, disinterested, distant, says she has no real interest in seeing Lancelot, that she would herself really rather wait for Gawain to come so that Gawain can accompany her home. What could cause the queen to act this way towards the one we know she loves and the one who has been yearning to be in her sight? He goes off, being captured, escaping, captured and recaptured once more, until word comes back to her that he has died. He then hears that she has died of sorrow and misery at the way that she's treated him, and he fashions a noose from the rope around his horse's neck and turns it into a noose to kill himself with, and is only restrained from killing himself by his fellow knights, who catch him at a very terrifying moment. We have something that might have been Romeo and Juliet at this moment, in other words, and it's all avoided. It's avoided because the queen recognizes that she has been wrong. She recognizes with anxiety that she's contrite in her behavior, that she investigates her own conscience and says that she has been cruel. Lancelot, who has no idea what it is that he could have done that might have offended his lady, finally comes into her presence, and he turns to her and says first, "My lady, I wonder very much why. When you saw me, you behaved as you did. You never uttered a word to me. You almost dealt me a mortal blow, and I was not so bold as to question you about it the way I'm questioning you now. Please tell me what crime I committed so that I can give you redress, so that I can amend my ways." It's as if he's going to confession to the queen. What can I do to change whatever I did in order to make it better? The queen says, "Were you not ashamed of being the knight on the cart? Were you not ashamed that you got on the cart? You showed great reluctance," she said, "to climb in when you hesitated for a pause of 2 steps. That pause," she said, "was why I refused to address you or speak to you." "May God save me," said Lancelot, "from doing such a wrong a second time. May God never have mercy on me if you're not absolutely right. My lady, accept my apology here and now." Her anger, her coldness, was a result not of Lancelot's getting into the cart and acting like a felon or some kind of terrible criminal. Her anger was because he considered his honor before he considered her welfare. And that one moment, or 2 moments, we should say, of hesitation defined her attitude towards him. How did she know? As I say, in this story, in this romance, in this poem, everyone seems to know everything about everybody except about Lancelot and Guinevere. The queen agrees at that point to meet him at night at a window whose iron bars Lancelot breaks, again wounding his hands, and he comes to her. In the morning, first Meleagant and then Bagdemagus see blood in Guinevere's bed, and they accuse her of having committed adultery with Kay, who was wounded when he captured her, and whose blood-soaked bed is next to hers. As Lancelot injured his hands by breaking the window bars, the blood is his. But can he truthfully defend the queen? Yes, he can legitimately defend her honor against Bagdemagus's very specific accusation, "You slept with Kay." Lancelot could say, "No, she did not sleep with Kay, and I will prove this upon you that she did not do so." Again he triumphs, and Bagdemagus and the queen again beg for Meleagant's life. As they return to court, however, Lancelot is once more imprisoned by Meleagant and then freed by Meleagant's sister, who owed Lancelot a favor. And it's Gawain who ends up escorting the queen home. The lady who holds Lancelot a prisoner this last time sets him free temporarily to let him go fight in a tournament of ladies, each of whom is seeking to find the bravest knight as her husband. And Arthur, always passive and agreeable in this tale, agreed to have Guinevere attend this tournament. At the queen's secret order, Lancelot first for the whole day plays the coward, only in the end, again at the queen's specific order, does he defeat everyone. And the ladies are forlorn because they all know that they cannot have this brave and most extraordinary knight to marry themselves. He returns to Arthur's court, where at the agreed time he kills Meleagant in combat. And there the story ends. What happens to this story? Does Chrétien abandon it or end it because there's no way to resolve the tension between love and morality in the story, which is full of strange pieces of verbal trickery, each one of which shows the ineffectiveness of the king and the terrible and painful, magnificent, adulterous love of Lancelot and Guinevere. It's too difficult to resolve. Next time, we'll look at the poem Yvain, where Chrétien finds some different resolutions to his problems.